So when someone can boast that an article she wrote for the New Atlantic is the most read article in the history of that prestigious magazine, she has passed over some awesome company. The Atlantic began publication in 1857 and has featured the work of Mark Twain, Emily Dickinson, Martin Luther King, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Ernest Hemingway. But our speaker today, Anne Marie Slaughter, wrote that major article on gender inequity 2 years ago, and it put her at the forefront in a brewing national discussion. From being a foreign policy advisor in the Obama administration and a political science professor at Princeton, she immediately achieved stature as a thought leader on feminist issues. She is the Bert Kerstetter Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton, and a year ago was named president of the New America, recently changed name, no longer New America Foundation. The foundation is a nonpartisan think tank that shares objective information with policymakers, the media, and the public, and focuses on a wide range of issues, including national security studies, technology, asset building, health, gender, energy, education, and the economy. She previously served as the dean of Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs from 2002 to 2009, and later she was the first woman to serve as director of policy planning for the Department of State from 2009 to 2011. Foreign Affairs magazine calls Dr. Slaughter one of the top 100 global thinkers. I'm proud to present one of America's most outstanding scholars and thought leaders, Anne Marie Slaughter. Please welcome her.
Thank you. So that was a lovely introduction. I do have to acknowledge that, of course, Mark Twain and Ralph Waldo Emerson did not have the advantage of social media. And it is just conceivable that if they had, I might not hold on to my title, but I'll take it. I'm delighted to be in Indianapolis. I also want to start by thanking Jamie Marisotis here, who I think 9 months ago or so said, you know, it sure would be great if you could come out to Indianapolis, and I was happy to do it for many reasons, but I also have to say the Lumina Foundation is a leading light of this city. It is really changing the face of higher education in this country. I say that in part because they are funding New America, so I think we are changing the face of higher education in this country, but also in terms of the kind of foundation it is as a philanthropic leader and really practicing leadership philanthropy, you should take great pride. It was particularly nice to be able to be here and to be all of your guests. So I'm going to talk about some of the themes of a book that will be coming out in the spring, and I certainly hope if you're listening to me now, you'll still want to read it then, and I'll be happy to come back. What I'm going to talk about now is the result of 2 years of giving speeches to every conceivable audience you can think of, up and down the income scale, across professions, from students to senior citizens, mostly women, about 20% men probably in many of my audiences. And my own thinking has changed a great deal since I wrote my article. They're the things I'm still perfectly committed to, but the ways I think we are going to get to real equality between men and women have changed. And that's what I will talk about in my speech. And then during the question period, I'm quite happy to talk about the world. I'm happy to talk about New America, anything you'd care to ask. So the next phase of the women's movement must be a men's movement. So let's start with where we are, which is where I started. And for those of you who hate the cover of The Atlantic, I didn't have anything to do with it. The Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In, and another wonderful book called Wonder Women, Sex, Power, and the Quest for Perfection, which is by Deborah Spar, the president of Barnard. All these books or articles start from the proposition that the women's movement has stalled, that we have revolutionized the lives of women, certainly since I grew up. I mean, you know, I'll tell one small anecdote. When we were watching John Kerry give a speech at the Democratic National Convention in 2012, my son, who was 15, said, "Who is that?" And I said, "Well, that's John Kerry. He's a senator. He ran for president. And if President Obama's reelected, he might be Secretary of State." And my son said, without missing a beat, "You mean a man can be Secretary of State?" So we have come a long, long way, because I could not have imagined a woman as Secretary of State growing up. But we're stuck, right? The numbers of women in leadership positions have not changed very much since 1990. We're stuck at somewhere between 15%, 20% in a very family-friendly industry, back down to 5% or lower when you're looking at the Fortune 500 or investment banking or other things. So we're stuck. So first thing I want to say is part of the reason we're stuck is because we are focusing exclusively on women, because we are talking about this as the women's movement, because most of the time when I talk about this, happily not now, I see mostly women in the audience. We need to be taking a much wider lens. So I'm going to start with Bill Gates, who knows a thing or two about the world. And this is something he said in the World Economic Forum at Davos in 2008. And he said, "The two great forces of nature, of human nature, are self-interest and caring for others." Now, he didn't say women. He didn't say men. He said human nature. And if you think about his own career, right, he knows a lot about competition. Microsoft did pretty well, still doing pretty well. He also, of course, through the Gates Foundation and all of his work since he stepped down as CEO of Microsoft, has been about caring for others. And one way to think about this is self-interest is obviously putting yourself first, and that's the world of competition, and everybody in this room knows a lot about it. And caring for others is putting others first. And all human beings, men or women, have both sides. So we're going to start with that. All right, so the women in this audience, most of you probably read some part of this book in college, so I want to talk about, again, what this means in terms of your personal life, if you're thinking about caring and competition, of self-interest and focusing on others. So Virginia Woolf wrote A Room of One's Own. That is a feminist manifesto. She said, to write fiction, a woman must have an income and a room of her own. And that is sort of the idea that you can't do it when you're just a wife or a mother or a sister or a daughter. Those things are really important. They're not conducive to writing novels. So you need a room of your own. But nobody ever said you wanted to live in a lighthouse, right? That room of your own, standing for your office or your home office, should be connected to a house in which people you love live. That can be your biological family. That can be a constructed family. That can be close friends. But people you love. So then if we start with that and we think all of us as human beings have this caring side and this competitive side, and again, if you think of our history, well, we wouldn't be here today if it weren't for competition and the ability of people to reach their dreams and to make things possible that no one had ever imagined. But we also wouldn't have made it past the first mammoth or saber-toothed tiger if we didn't take care of each other, right? We are not greatly endowed with ferocious characteristics, we survived as a race because we take care of each other. So real equality would be a world in which competitive and caring roles are equally open to and valued by women and men. Right? So all of us would have the opportunity to do both. Now, let me start by saying not all of us are split down the middle. My family, I'll tell you a little secret. My grandfather was an All-American football player for Michigan in the 20s. My family thinks I'm pretty competitive, right? I'm probably over here on the competitive side. And there are certainly some people who are much more on the nurturing side. And those are many women, also men. So I'm not saying everybody has this 50-50, but I'm saying most of us would like to be able to do both, and that means men as well as women. So here's a way to start by thinking about this. If you are in a same-sex marriage or you're a same-sex couple and you get married or you're together and you have children or you have to take care of your parents, there is no default role as to who's going to be the caregiver and who's going to be the breadwinner. Right? You just have to ask, all right, which of us is going to be doing one or the other, or how are we both going to do both, right? And there's no way to say, well, you're the woman, so you ought to do it, or you're the man, so you ought to do it. What you think about is, well, who's more committed to their career? Who's making more money? Who has the more flexible boss? Who more wants to be in one role or another? And those are the questions we should be asking in heterosexual couples as well, as opposed to starting out from the default assumption, you're the woman, you should be the caregiver, and equally importantly, you're the man, you should be the breadwinner. Because that constraint operates on men just as much as caregiving operates on women. So then I want to, if you've got thinking about that, thinking about all men and women, asking those questions, now let's think about what your career would look like if you assumed, as a man or a woman, that you're going to be taking care of somebody at some point. And for those of you who are maybe don't have children or don't want to have children, you do have a choice about that. You, at least till now, don't have a choice about having parents. Right? You do have parents. They will age. And they will need care. So if you're listening to me thinking, ah, she's talking about kids, no. This is caring for anyone, or caring for your spouse, or a sibling, or others in your extended family. So we have always thought about the career ladder in terms of one person in the workforce who has no caregiving responsibilities, who enters the workforce at 25, works like crazy to climb that ladder, retires at 65, dies at 75. That's the model of the 50s and 60s, and it's obviously not actually the model. I was pointing out earlier that Janet Yellen was 67 when she was named head of the Fed, and if Hillary runs and wins, she'll be 70 when she becomes president. I mean, it's obviously not the model we're living with, but it's still the model that most workplaces have in their heads, and that's the way work is structured. I want to suggest, if we really think about caregiving and breadwinning as something that everybody does, it makes more sense to think about your career in terms of interval training or intervals, care intervals and competition intervals. Not that you're going to only compete and then only give care, but that you're going to need to fit the two together. And when you're in intense caregiving periods, you're probably going to work differently. You're not going to take the big job that means you've got to be on a plane all the time, right? Or if you're going to take that job, then your spouse is not going to be able to take that job. For those of you who are athletes, interval training is how you get into your very best condition. This is good for you. This is good for your work and for your ability to be a caregiver. Thinking about your life as you're probably going to hold a lot of jobs. The younger people in this audience will hold many jobs. And those of you who have kids, you know, 5 years seems like an eternity at a job for many of the millennials who work at New America. So thinking about it as many different jobs where you can work very, very hard to get to the top of a particular area where you're working, whether that's all the way up the top or the highest position you can reach from where you are. And then there are going to be periods where, as I said, you either move laterally, you might work part-time, depending on your financial circumstances, but you take time for care. And again, it doesn't just have to be those you love. It might be caring about your community. It might be caring about a passion, something that you are absolutely devoted to that you want to give time to. One of the other ways to think about that helps that fit together, reimagining our careers as intervals, is thinking about a whole career, not in terms of a straight-up ascent of a series of titles where you start in the mailroom and go up to CEO, which was the old-fashioned idea, and again, we're far away from that now, but thinking not about a set of titles, but a portfolio of skills and experiences. That when you think about your career, and or you're advising the young people in your life to think about their career, you have them think about who do they want to be, and not how did that person get there, but what are all the skills and experiences that person has had. If you're a leader, you're probably a good writer, you're a good speaker, you're a strategist, you're a fundraiser, you're a manager, and then how can you get those experiences at different times in your life? What this does is to open up, if you are taking time out to be a caregiver, you might take a degree, you might learn online, you might get a certificate, you might decide to run a local organization and learn how to fundraise and manage. The point being that you can get the experiences even when you're not in a conventional workplace. Okay, so let me now then turn, that was talking about if thinking about your own life or your children's lives in terms of everybody, men and women, are going to be caregivers and breadwinners. Now let's talk about the workplace and what this would mean in the workplace. So you can see the starting point, and I said this in my Atlantic article, was that everything goes better with flexibility. Right? Flexibility makes it work. And I wrote this article after I had been in Washington, because until I went to Washington, I was an academic, which means you're your own boss. And then I was a dean, which still meant I was my own boss. In fact, until I came to Newark, I was 55 before my pay depended on my performance. Now, that might say a lot about government and academia, and we won't go there, but point being, I had always been able to make it work. And I do believe that if you give people the flexibility, if you tell them this is what needs to be done and you get it done the way you need to get it done, it will be much better. But the problem is not that companies don't have flexibility policies. Most good companies, most big companies have flexibility policies. They have part-time work. They have telework. They have you can flex time. That's not the issue. The issue is that if you take advantage of those policies, you are no longer on leadership track. So you are stigmatized. You are treated as if you're not committed to your career. You're treated as if you lost IQ points because you needed to work differently. That's crazy. That's stigma, right? If you have those policies on the books, then anyone, women or men, should be able to take advantage of them. And what it means is you're just working differently for a while. And if you're off leadership track, that's a problem. And parent groups should be start focusing on that dimension, the fact that we're still basically assuming that unless you're 24/7 committed, you're not entitled to be a leader. That's crazy, and it's wasting talent. Okay, so then let's think also about what else you could do in the workplace. So we have customized everything. The move from the industrial age to the digital age is the move from standardization to customization. Terry, you talked about the Starbucks, right? So that's where I started. I still remember when you ordered a cup of coffee and people said milk or sugar, and that was kind of it, right? So now we have a half-calf soy latte with a caramel shot, right? Or whatever your little mind can devise for what you want to drink. And the same thing, of course, I remember CDs and albums where you actually listened to what the artist thought you should listen to. Now we have playlists. You decide, right? And that's happening in education too, right? Very soon you are going to be customizing your education. You can, you know, design your own running shoes. The place that is least customized is the workplace. It's still standardized. So the other way to think about this is that the best workplaces customize their workers' experiences in ways that help them get and retain the best talent. And I use Deloitte and Touche as an example where they have this concept of mass career customization. Everybody at Deloitte gets counseled as to how they are going to fit their career together with the other parts of their life. And it's been very successful, not only in retaining women, but simply in making them a great place to work. Okay, so then let's talk about efficiency. We've talked about customization. We've talked about flexibility. So my mantra as a leader has always been, if family comes first, work does not come second. And what I mean by this is if you let people take care of their family obligations, in the first place, they will be able to focus on work. I don't know about you, but if you have a sick parent, a sick spouse, a child who is at school waiting for you, and you know that that child's alone while you're, you know, getting Worst Mother of the Year award, if not worse, and so you're not working. You're not focusing on your work. You let people take care of what they have to take care of, and they will get the work done, and they will be loyal. They will want to work for you. I've tried this out in many different places. Actually, things will come together. And it is not hard to implement. Frankly, I wouldn't want to hire someone who put the job ahead of a child or a spouse or a parent. That's not the kind of person I want working for me. I think that person has really bad values. But I do want them to work hard. And if you let them put their family first, that will happen. So the other point is that it leads to much better management, right? If you actually don't let people work round the clock and you don't think that that is what defines a great worker, and you give people the opportunity to have, in this case, sleeping with your smartphone is by a Harvard Business School professor who did a study at Boston Consulting Group, the idea of predictable time off. So consultants work all the time. This was every member of a consulting team had to have one night off a week. So one night off, you had to leave at 6, and you could go work out. You could go on a date with your wife. You could do whatever you wanted to do. But you had to take it. And so, of course, everybody said, sure, we'd love to do that. And then the client called and said they had a big presentation, and whoever was supposed to take that night off said, ooh, I can't do it now. Nope. You had to do it. Well, what did that mean? Well, it meant they had to tell their second in command what they were doing, because if they had to leave, somebody had to pick up what they were doing. And that led to far greater communication. Then the communication led to, well, do we really all four need to fly to the clients all 4 days? Maybe there are better ways to do this. That led to efficiencies, more productivity, so successfully that now every team at BCG has to do this. And there are 40 people at BCG who are facilitating this process because it was so good for the bottom line. So give you an example of how this can make things much more efficient. And finally, the creative workplace. I will not go through all the neuroscience and science on what makes creativity here, but that top top picture of the pool table, that's Google. And Google's doing pretty well. I don't know if you've noticed. They seem to be doing all right. You walk into the Google building and you think you are in a playground. I kid you not. There's Lego, there's pool, there's ping pong, there are all sorts of outdoor sports. They believe that play and creativity go hand in hand. And they do. And again, a lot of look at Nobel laureates, the geniuses, they will often tell you that being able to reimagine the world, being able to sort of have that sense of wonder that you often have when you're playing in various ways is part of creativity. The other thing that we know is that you can't be creative unless you have lots of different inputs into your life. If you do the same thing 24/7, you cannot make unusual connections because there's nothing to connect to. If you take walks, go to movies, read books, go to plays, do other things, it's those unusual connections that make you better at your job. Okay, so you may be sitting there saying she's been talking for 20 minutes and we haven't heard about a men's movement. Let me explain why I say that the next phase of the women's movement is a men's movement. So I've talked about how you rethink about your career if you think that you're going to be a caregiver and a breadwinner at different parts of your life. You can't predict exactly when, but you can predict at some point what you do in the workplace to get there. But we can't actually get there unless we transform men's lives as much as we've transformed women's lives. So my life is radically different than my mother's life was. Right? And my life is radically different than what I could have imagined in Virginia in the 60s and then the 70s when I came of age. So when I came of age, the women's movement was just really gaining steam. But so now, if I were to have a daughter, I'd raise her to say, you can be anything. And that anything means anything professionally, but it also means absolutely you can take time out to be a mom, to be the person you want to be in terms of your family or those you love, just as much as you can be professionally. But we don't raise our sons that way. I thought about this recently when I have two sons, and until I started writing this book, I realized I still pretty much assume my sons are going to be breadwinners. I assume daughters will be breadwinners too, but it doesn't ever occur to me that my son might not be a breadwinner because men are still being raised the way they've always been raised and the way certainly they were raised in the 50s. What's the worth of a man? It's his job. It's his career. Certainly he's a good father, but how do we define fatherhood for a man? As a provider, right? We don't define fatherhood as a man as the guy who is there in the same nurturing way that we often think of a mother. And that's not fair to men. This was what surprised me most after my article, was I got lots of letters from men who said, if you think that we have it all, and you think this is our choice, that I don't get to be there when my kid is playing baseball, that I don't get to be there when my teenager needs me, that I don't get the choice of saying I'm going to work part-time and maybe pursue my dream, no. This is not the way I would have designed life. Now, many of you are probably thinking, yeah, but women wanted to be like men, but men don't want to be like women. Men don't want to be caregivers. Women just want to be competitors. Well, that's exactly what people said about women in the 50s. Women don't want to be in the workforce. Women don't want to compete. Women don't have that. That's not part of them. But, of course, that's not true. You can be fully feminine and be an Olympic gold medalist and have kids, right? Misty May, I'm going to forget her last name, but the wonderful volleyball player, right? So you can do both as a woman. Why can't you do both as a man? So to get there, we're going to have to change the way we think about what a real man is. And I look at somebody like my husband, who has a good job, who certainly brings in an income, but who is the lead parent and has repeatedly put my career ahead of his career. And I think he's a fabulous man. I actually think he's an incredibly secure and courageous man because he's doing that at a time when that is not the norm, just as early women in the workplace were real pioneers. The other reason we have to do this is that those men at the top, those Fortune 500 CEOs, they all have lead parents at home. They did not get there by trying to do both. Many of us can do both, but you get to a certain level and you've got to be fully focused on your job, and that means somebody else has to be at home. So for the women in the crowd or the men who want to see their daughters or their wives succeed, unless they have somebody supporting them at home as the lead parent or the available parent, basically the person who is there when the school or the doctor calls or the police calls and says, you're a teenager and you're whatever it is, somebody has to be there, right? And so unless we can free things up for men, women aren't going to get there either. But my point is men are not being allowed to be the full human beings they can be. All right, last word. So to let men be the lead parent or the lead caregiver in various ways, women have got to get rid of our own sexism. So for all the women in the audience, just imagine the following hypothetical. You walk into the office, and your boss, who's a man, says, I'm biologically better at this, but I think you can do it if I micromanage you enough. If I write long lists of what you have to do every 5 to 10 half hour, and when I travel, I'll call every hour to make sure you're doing it. Now, the women in the audience know full well that's how many of us treat our husbands, right? We do not really think they can do it as well as we can. We really don't. We think that we know better. In fact, we wouldn't say it this way, but we kind of do believe biologically we were better suited for this. Now, that's just not true. The main thing is they're going to do it differently. There's no question they're going to do it differently. The Prime Minister of Norway, when she went into the cabinet at 35, they had 4 kids. And her husband said to her, I want you to do this. I'm totally behind you. But I'm going to do it my way. And my husband said that to me, too. I'm going to do it my way. You don't like it? Fine. You do it. Well, no, I couldn't do it, right? There's nothing that says that he liked the way I was doing it. It's just that if you're the one who's home, you do it your way. There is no, yes, the house is going to probably be a lot messier, right? It may look like a sports camp. He may be tougher. He may do all sorts of things you don't like. But it is not ordained that women know how to raise children and men don't. So to really get there, we're going to have a men's movement, and we as women are going to have to let men run houses or whatever, raise kids, take care of parents the way they want to do it. So suppose we thought of the whole thing like this. Suppose we said, my husband supports me, and we thought of it like this. My husband is supporting my ability to reach my dreams, just as I hope to support his ability, if you can trade off over a lifetime. And suppose we said real equality and inclusive leadership, imagining leaders across the board in every shape, gender, color, the works, go hand in hand. And suppose we then said all of this, thinking about men and women as being full human beings, expressing all parts of their nature in their different ways. And I am not saying men and women are not different. I live with 3 men. We are different. That we then thought all of this motivates and allows everyone to do their best. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anne-Marie. And as a reminder, please use the white cards on your table if you have a question for Anne-Marie, or tweet us at Economic Club IN. So I'm going to go ahead and get us started with questions as you all write some at your table.
You can ask about Syria if you want to.
So Anne-Marie, your background and specialty is in foreign policy. Did your article commandeer your focus, and do you regret stepping to the front on gender issues?
That's a question I do get. It did commandeer my life completely. 3 days after the article went up on the Atlantic website, I'd been in Scotland with my family and my on a vacation, and sort of a work vacation, and I landed. And I was on the front page of the New York Times, and there was a picture of me versus Sheryl Sandberg, and my phone was ringing off the hook, and my mother called and said, "What have you done?" And I worried about that. I mean, I really was sort of panicked. It was like my entire foreign policy existence just got wiped out. And if you Google me, most people will, if you've ever heard of me, far more people will have heard of me for this than anything I've done in foreign policy. But I also feel like I wrote the article because I felt like we needed a conversation, and it would be churlish. It would really be churlish for me to stand up and say, "Well, gee, this was, now there's a huge conversation and it's ruining my life." I can't say that. So what I feel, I do want to go back to foreign policy, but I feel that this was something that I felt impelled to do, and I've been really given the gift of having a platform where I hope to be able not only to start a conversation, but to move us toward progress. So I'm content, but I'm not giving up foreign policy.
I'm going to shift gears. I'm going to ask you to tell us about New America and what it seeks to accomplish.
So New America, you heard that we used to be the New America Foundation. We're not a foundation. I got tired of people asking me for money. If you would like to be a foundation, we have one sitting. So we were founded as a think tank in 1999 to create a new generation of public intellectuals. And one of our trademarks is that we give these fellowships to people who have big ideas, and we try to want them to write those ideas in books that will be widely read. We've had 6 best-selling books in the last 2 years alone, and we look for people who are undiscovered at points in their career, and we try to launch them in getting them an agent or whatever. So that's where we were founded. What we're trying to do today is reinvent the entire idea of what a think tank is. So we're called New America. We think that it is important to do policy research, no question. I know there's somebody here from the Indiana University Policy Institute. I believe in policy. I've run a public policy school. But that can only be part of solving public problems today. Think tanks were created to help government govern well. Well, today, writing papers and sending it down the street to Capitol Hill, even if it's a great paper and even if you get it to a senator or a member of Congress, change is not all that likely to result. So what we think you need is you need big ideas, you need policy research, you need technology. You need to marry what is the technological solution with what is the political solution. We have actual software engineers or coders on staff. They're developing products. But more importantly, if you're thinking about education, you know about the best learning technologies. But unlike California, you don't think that just inventing a new technology will change the world and you don't have to do anything else. You marry the two. We also believe in broad public conversation. And critically, because I'm here in Indianapolis, we believe you have to be connected to communities. So we are going to, we're in New York now. We hope to open in San Francisco. I'd like to see Chicago, Miami, Indianapolis, any place that things are really happening on the ground. The think tanks, and I don't call us a think tank, I call us a civic enterprise of this century, have to have all those elements. They have to be connected to the community. They have to have technology, policy, intellectual venture capital, and a very broad public conversation. End of pitch.
So I'm going to try and keep balanced questions between Syria and stigma. You're going to go back and forth, so I apologize. Do you think the Obama administration made a mistake by not intervening in the Syrian situation much earlier than it did?
Yes.
Okay.
I will elaborate briefly. I wrote my first op-ed on intervening more in Syria in February of 2012. So that's 2.5 years ago. Because 2.5 years ago, when I went back and reread it, you could see that unless we did something, Syria was going to come completely apart. And you could see that in that process, it was very likely to support the most extreme groups because there were already conflicts between moderates and extremists. And unless you support the moderates, the extremists will wipe them out. That happened with socialists and communists. It always happens. And you could see that it would spread to the rest of the Middle East. So this has all been foreseeable. The problem has been at every turn, well, we don't know what to do, and it's hard, and I agree with that. But the point was, inaction has steadily made it worse. And if we don't act today, then in 2 years, ISIS is not only going to be that much stronger, but Syria, as we know it, won't exist at all. Turkey will no longer have a Kurdish area. You're going to have Kurds trying to create an independent Kurdistan from Turkey, Iraq, and Syria. Iraq will be completely destabilized. Jordan will be destabilized. And we will be looking at ungoverned spaces in the most volatile area of the world, the most deadly area of the world, and one of the most economically important areas of the world. So, yes, they should have acted sooner. And no matter how hard it is, we have to do something now, or we're just going to find ourselves in really a space I don't even want to contemplate.
So we have several folks in the audience, single women, and they've been told that they need to do it all before they get married. And so what type of conversation do you have before marriage in order to be mutually supportive in home and career?
Wow. So the first thing to say is if you are going to get married, you'll sit down with your spouse, and your spouse, if he's a man, or if she's a woman, but particularly if he's a man, he will say he supports your career 100%. And I think he will mean it. I don't mean that he's going to mouth that. I really think he's going to mean it. But what he doesn't think about is the following questions, which is what you have to say. So, okay, you support my career, I support your career. Will you move for me? That's a big one. And when I get that career promotion that says we have to pick up and go halfway across the country, and many of you know that's what it takes, right, in incorporation, will you move for me? Will you defer your promotion so I can take my promotion? Because that's what it comes down to. That's when women get knocked out, right? It's when everybody's going along, you're managing it, and one of you, and it's often the man, gets that opportunity, and you got to move. And so who gives up their career or changes their career or does something a little less than they might want? That's the conversation you have to have, because unless those answers are yes, you're not there. Or at least, yes, we'll sit down and make that decision together. At least I'm prepared to contemplate it. You can't know, and part of it will be who's earning more, and part of it will be who has the best prospects. But that's what has to happen. The second thing, though, is I don't think we're going to get there by doing it all before you get married or before kids. I mean, I was appalled at the news that the tech companies were offering egg freezing benefits. I mean, this is not the way we're going to make this change. I'm not saying that in, you know, some circumstances that may not be the thing you have to do, but the way to do this is not to assume we're not going to have kids conceived the way we used to tell them they were conceived with the birds and the bees, and I speak from experience. We have to get to a place where you have 10 years out of college where you can travel and you can do all these things, and you can work incredibly hard, you can get to a certain place, and then if you are going to have a family, and again, it's later if you're caring for your own parents, but if you're talking about kids, there's a 15 to 20 year period in there where absolutely you should still be working, but you're probably going to have to move laterally for a while, or you're going to have to work in different ways. And I think it's better to think about that and then think what you're going to do on the other side of that, or else you're going to stay working full time and your spouse will alternate, than it is to assume somehow you're going to get it all done and then get married and then have kids. It's got to be integrated.
I was going to ask you when you think the first female president will be, but I just got one saying, would you consider running for president? So,
not till my kids have left the house. No.
Let's see. I have a young son, and I teach at a college for men. What practical steps might we take to spur the kind of men's movement that you have described?
That's a great question. So for years as a professor, young women students would come in, and we would talk about work and family and how you did it. And I would advise them. I would talk about my own experience delaying childbirth and how that had not been such a great experience. And we talk very frankly, and I would talk about, you know, think now how you're going to shape your career so that you can have a family if you want a family and you're in a position to have one. I never asked my male students that question until I wrote the article. And then I started saying to everybody who came in, I'd say to young men as well as to young women, have you thought about how you're going to fit together your career and your family? So the first thing we can do is that. You know, it takes two to create children, and that hasn't changed. So it takes two to raise them. So they have equal responsibility. So we should be asking men as much as we ask women, how are you going to put these two things together? And similarly, in the office, when somebody comes in and says, if it's a man, we're expecting a child, because now lots of guys say we're pregnant. They're not. But the idea is approved. I mean, I do appreciate the sentiment. But the thing that you... The thing you should then say is, how are you going to manage that? Because every woman in this room has either been asked that question or heard it asked, right? But we should be asking men the same way. So the way we do this is just to walk the talk, to assume if both are responsible, then both have to fit it together. Now, I'm going to tell you one way in which this kind of backfires, because my 18-year-old who wants to be an actor. And, you know, it's hard when your kid wants to be an actor. You don't want to say, there's no chance on earth you're going to make it. That's not a good message as a parent. You don't do that. You say, you're great, and he is. I think he's wonderful. I think he's the next Brad Pitt, but I'm just not so sure that Hollywood will agree with me. So I said, you need a plan B. And Edward said, well, I got a plan B. I'm going to marry a rich woman. I said... So I said, no, 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 that is not your plan B. And he looks at me, because he's lived with me for a long time, he says, you're being sexist. I mean, when girls say they're going to marry a rich guy, that's okay. So how come it's not okay for me to say I'm going to marry a rich woman? Well, of course, there's an answer. That's not actually a life strategy for either sex. We should not encourage that. But my point is just, you know, the sort of... He's very sensitive to female sexism in a way that I would not have thought of. And, of course, he is, in fact, right in that regard.
That's all the time that we have. Let's hear for our wonderful speaker. Terrific speech. Information and tickets for each season's presenters can be found on our website, economicclubofindiana.com. Have a wonderful afternoon. Thank you.